Hello, dear listener, and welcome to A-Minder. I'm your host today. My name is Nyla, and I'm a postdoctoral researcher at McGill University in Montreal. And I am pleased to be recording this on a rather gloomy gray day here in Montreal to bring you the August update on non-pharmacological strategies for preventing or managing aspects of Alzheimer's disease. We'll cover a range from music to the role of circadian rhythms to ultrasound, right after this introduction.
Welcome to A-Minder, a podcast where we summarize the latest publications on Alzheimer's disease for you, so you can spend more time doing awesome research. For every month, you'll find a series of episodes by theme, and each comes with a bibliography. Whether you're in the lab, on the bus, or cooking your meal, we hope you find this podcast useful and accessible.
In today's episode, I'll be taking you through 11 papers that were published or appeared on PubMed, rather, in August 2022. And I've separated these into cognitive training, exercise and metabolism, and then after the break, we'll get into neuromodulatory techniques. If you've been following my episodes for a while, these topics should sound familiar to you, but if not, I'll try to introduce each one along the way. And if you are new to A-Minder, this is just a little disclaimer or an orientation that what we do here is summarize based on the abstracts of the papers we find on PubMed. So these are peer-reviewed articles, but we do not get into any of the details, nor do we critique the articles. We leave that up to you. So if you would like to follow up on any of the papers you hear today, you can find them in the bibliography attached to this episode. So with that said, let's jump into our first section on cognitive training. And cognitive training can refer to a number of different exercises and tasks that researchers have developed in order to stimulate or to challenge various cognitive functions. Of course, a lot of this work has focused on memory, but given that Alzheimer's disease also affects other cognitive domains, there really is a broad range of the different tasks and the different ways that they are presented in the hopes of preventing or slowing cognitive decline, or in some cases, just finding alternative ways around cognitive impairment that already exists. In our first paper today, we're looking at strategies to improve memory. Specifically, the authors look at training mnemonic skills, that is, making specific associations that assist in remembering, and memory compensatory strategies, which can include things like using a calendar or writing down information. First author Kim, and last author also named Kim, developed a cognitive rehabilitation program that they first set out to test in older adults without dementia in their study entitled Effects of a Cognitive Rehabilitation Program Based on Mnemonic Skills and Memory Compensatory Strategies for Older Adults, a Pilot Study. Paper 1 was published in Medicine, and the authors are coming at you from Kyungpuk National University Hospital in South Korea. The program the authors developed consisted of 8 weekly sessions, which they assessed in an open-label single-arm pilot study. In other words, all participants knowingly underwent the training program. There wasn't a control condition. The authors recruited around 40 participants who either had normal cognitive function or mild cognitive impairment, which is MCI from now on, and they administered cognitive tests before and after the training program. So those tests included things such as the Euro Quality of Life 5 dimension, a test for depression, one on subjective memory complaints, and then neuropsychological assessment battery that is used for looking at cognitive function in Alzheimer's. They report that 32 participants completed the study, and that memory compensatory strategies significantly improved verbal memory function in older adults without cognitive impairment. For those with MCI, the same training program improved language ability, verbal recognition memory, nonverbal memory, attention, and processing speed. The authors conclude that memory compensatory strategies improved cognitive function in 2 distinct populations and suggest that this positive effect may be seen in both the trained and non-trained cognitive domains. Beyond developing the content of cognitive training programs, researchers are also thinking about how to incentivize people to actually stick with doing the training regularly. Gamifying is one common strategy for packaging the cognitive exercises in a more fun way and making it feel less like a chore. I covered a paper on a game-based cognitive training strategy in my last episode, that is the July 2022 series, and I've got another one for you today. So paper number 2 is published in BMC Psychiatry. The first author is Brill, and actually it's a shared first authorship with Krebs, and the last author is Klöpe. This is primarily from the University of Bern in Switzerland and the Swiss Institute for Translational and Entrepreneurial Medicine. And the title of paper 2 is, Can a Serious Game-Based Cognitive Training Attenuate Cognitive Decline Related to Alzheimer's Disease? Protocol for a Randomized Controlled Trial. This paper presents the protocol for an upcoming randomized controlled trial, so there are no results to report on just yet. The authors plan to recruit 162 participants at risk of AD and with at least subjective cognitive decline, who will be randomized to one of three groups. The first group will undergo a serious game-based computerized cognitive training program. The second is a passive control group in which participants are placed on a waitlist. And the third is an active control group in which participants watch documentaries. The training condition will consist of daily at-home sessions for 10 weeks, totaling 50 sessions, in addition to weekly on-site group meetings. The participants will then continue the training for an extra 20 weeks with a monthly on-site booster session. The authors don't detail what the game-based computerized cognitive training entails in the abstract, so I invite you to check out the details in the paper if you're interested. In terms of outcome measures, they'll evaluate changes in three cognitive domains through a comprehensive cognitive assessment, and will conduct functional and structural magnetic resonance imaging to examine any neuronal underpinnings of the therapeutic effects they hope to see. So hopefully I'll report on the results of this study in an episode down the line. Dear listener, have you come across any of the astounding videos on social media, or maybe you have an example from real life, of how music can ignite a person? Specifically, I'm talking about the context of Alzheimer's disease here, and how music can evoke feelings, memories, or other aspects of one's personality that otherwise appear dormant. There's a whole literature on how music is being used as a complementary therapy for dementia, and also to support relational person-centered care. Check out the documentary Music is Life if you're interested in the latter. Anyway, the reason for my little sidetrack here is that paper 3 brings us into music research, but more specifically into assessing the neural response to music stimulation in people with varying stages of dementia. Paper number 3 is entitled Spatial Temporal Dynamics of Entropy in EEGS During Music Stimulation of Alzheimer's Disease Patients with Different Degrees of Dementia. It was published in Entropy by first author Wu and last author Yang, and this is coming primarily from Hangzhou Tianzi University in China. This study consisted of 17 patients with mild to moderate dementia, 16 with severe dementia, and 16 healthy elderly participants. The authors conducted electroencephalogram or EEG recordings before, during, and following music stimulation. Check the paper for specifics on the music stimulation, as these are not included in the abstract. Skipping right to the results, the authors report that EEG responses were statistically different between patients with mild to moderate dementia compared to those with severe dementia, both at the level of the whole temporal brain area and in subregions. They mention several specific EEG characteristics, but one I'll highlight here is that as the degree of dementia progressed, fewer EEG characteristics when they compared them showed significant differences among brain regions in response to music. These findings suggest that dementia severity changes the neuronal response to music stimulation, which could be helpful for guiding more targeted musical therapy treatments and for investigating the neural mechanisms underlying music perception. So we are on to our next section here on exercise and metabolism. I have named it such because, as you'll see, these next three papers are actually quite varied, but they all have something to do with the effects of diet and exercise on metabolism and on brain pathology and cognitive function. Usually we cover quite a few papers on exercise every month, and this can range from animal models and really mechanistic studies to different training regimens in humans. And today I just have one paper on exercise for you. This one is entitled Exercise Dose and Aerobic Fitness Response in Alzheimer's Dementia, Findings from the FIT-AD Trial. The first author is Salisbury and the last author is Yu. Coming from University of Minnesota and Arizona State University, and paper number 4 was published in the International Journal of Sports Medicine. The study population comprised community-dwelling older adults with mild to moderate Alzheimer's dementia who were randomly assigned either to the aerobic exercise intervention or to a stretching group. The aerobic exercise consisted of moderate to vigorous intensity cycling, 3 times a week over 6 months. The authors assessed cardiorespiratory fitness by peak oxygen consumption and peak walking distance, and the aerobic exercise dose was calculated using a new heart rate physical activity score. They report that in the aerobic exercise group, participants who achieved the maximal criteria on the cardiopulmonary exercise test also had significantly increased peak oxygen consumption. In the same subset, the aerobic exercise dose was strongly and significantly correlated to change in peak oxygen consumption. That said, the intervention and stretching group did not differ in their changes in oxygen consumption or in peak walking distance, which was assessed through 2 different tests. The authors conclude that studies on aerobic exercise programs for people with AD should place emphasis on exercise dose, as this is a key variable in determining the possible benefits of cardiorespiratory fitness. We're switching over to a very different treatment strategy for paper number 5. This is fecal transplants. You heard that right, dear listener, and that might sound odd to you, but there's a good reason to believe that transplanting fecal microbiota from healthy individuals could help in treating certain neurological disorders because of the gut-brain axis. We're finding out more and more about how bacteria in the gut influence the brain and could play a big role in neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, despite their tiny size. Let's hear more from first author Park and last author Choi at Inhai University Hospital and School of Medicine in the Republic of China, with paper 5 entitled Fecal Microbiota Transplantation Can Improve Cognition in Patients with Cognitive Decline and Clostridioides difficile infection. Sorry for my hesitation there, but I'm not used to pronouncing bacteria names. This paper was published in Aging. So right off the bat, you should know this paper doesn't actually study Alzheimer's directly, but as you heard in the title, it instead looks at patients with, let's try it again, Clostridioides difficile infection, which I will now refer to as CDI. And these patients can also have dementia. This paper would usually be excluded in our search criteria, but I'm going to cover it anyway because the effects on cognitive impairment could be relevant for Alzheimer's research as well. The authors note that previous fecal microbiota transplantation for CDI patients led to cognitive improvement, so they were interested in testing the effects on cognition more directly in this study. They recruited 10 patients with dementia and severe CDI, 8 of which were female, to undergo the transplantation. An additional 10 patients with CDI and dementia were age and sex matched, but received antibiotic treatment instead to act as a control group. Cognitive function was tested 1 month before and after the treatment using the mini mental state exam and clinical dementia rating scale sum of boxes. So those are 2 tests that are commonly used in Alzheimer's research. And the fecal samples were analyzed to compare the patient's gut microbiota composition before and 3 weeks after treatment. Not only did the patients who received the fecal microbiota transplantation show improvement in clinical symptoms, but they also had significantly improved cognitive function, specifically on their MMSE and clinical dementia rating scores compared to the antibiotics group. The gut microbiota composition was also altered, with an enrichment in proteobacteria and bacteroidetes. I just looked up a video, and I want to share with you, dear listener, that when you look up these pronunciation videos, some of them are like to smooth background elevator music with a really nice drawly voice saying, how do you pronounce it? Bacteroidetes. So I will spare you my imitations, but there you have it in case you want a little detour on the internet today. Coming back to this paper, these findings add to the growing literature on the connection between the gut microbiome and cognitive function, and suggest that fecal microbiota transplantation could delay cognitive decline in patients with dementia. We are switching modes once again for paper number 6, but staying in the realm of metabolism. You may already know that type 2 diabetes mellitus is a significant risk factor for AD, but did you know that circadian rhythms might also factor into the equation? Let us learn more with paper number 6, published in the Journal of Nutritional Biochemistry by first author Peng and last author Yang. This is from Huazhong University of Science and Technology in Wuhan, China, and the title is Time-Restricted Feeding Rescues Circadian Disruption Aggravated Progression of Alzheimer's Disease in Diabetic Mice. So as you just heard, this study is moving us away from humans and into the rodent kingdom. We're looking at a mouse model of type 2 diabetes in which the authors have previously observed that disrupting circadian rhythms aggravated a progression of Alzheimer's-like symptoms. In this study, they test whether time-restricted feeding could act as a potential synchronizer and therefore have a protective effect against this circadian disruption. To test this, they compared 6-week-old male diabetic mice to wild-type mice, that is, control mice. They kept the mice either on a regular light-dark cycle to mimic a normal day, or an altered cycle in which they received 6 hours of light and 18 hours in the dark. The mice were further split into 2 groups. The first could eat whenever they wanted, and the second had food restricted to 8 hours during the active dark period. This went on for 8 weeks, at the end of which behavior and cognition was tested on the open field test, the novel object recognition test, and the Barnes-Mays test. The authors also looked at the circadian-related gene expression, body weight, lipid levels, and AD-associated tau phosphorylation. Okay, that was a lot, so what did they find? Firstly, the altered light-dark cycle did disrupt circadian rhythms in the diabetic mice, as expected, and caused cognitive impairment as well as increased tau phosphorylation. Time-restricted feeding prevented the circadian disruption and its negative effect on cognition and tau phosphorylation, in addition to mitigating the body weight increase and lipid accumulation seen in the diabetic, circadian-disrupted mice. In the wild-type mice, the altered light-dark cycle also disrupted circadian rhythms, but didn't cause any Alzheimer's-related changes seen in the diabetic mice. So as much as we complain about routine, maybe it's not all bad. And with that, we are at our halfway point. I invite you to get up and stretch, if that's not what you're already doing, listening to this podcast, or do whatever you need to, and we will be back shortly with neuromodulatory techniques for the rest of the episode.
I want to take a short break to convince you to join me and the editing team here at Aminder. We are responsible for the high-quality, polished episodes you hear, and our team is looking to grow so that we can cover even more episodes in a month. If you're interested in learning the ropes, send us an email at aminderpodcast@gmail.com. We do have other positions on our team if you're interested in those. I find it to be a rewarding auditory and visual challenge, and I love working behind the scenes to get the best out of our hosts. So if you want to feel like a superhero after editing out mistakes seamlessly, please reach out to me and to the Aminder team.
Nearly 1 million older Canadians live with a form of dementia. This number is expected to double within 10 years, and sadly no solutions exist yet to dramatically reduce these numbers. It has to stop. Research can help solve this problem. We are 350 researchers fully dedicated towards preventing and finding a cure to dementia, and to improve care to those living with dementia. We are the Canadian Consortium on Neurodegeneration and Aging. The solution to dementia could be closer than you think.
Welcome back to my disembodied voice. I'm now going to be sharing 5 papers with you on different neuromodulatory techniques. So the next 5 papers all pertain to using some kind of stimulation method to affect neuronal activity, or in some other way target Alzheimer's pathology, such as promoting toxic amyloid beta clearance. You're likely familiar with transcranial magnetic stimulation and electric current stimulation. Those are the 2 most common ways researchers and clinicians manipulate brain activity without using pharmacology. These carry some advantages compared to drug development in that they're often non-invasive and easier to administer, in some ways, I should say, and they don't come with the same off-target effects that can cause unwanted side effects in drug use. That said, the temporal and spatial precision of stimulating neural activity through electrodes placed on the scalp is quite tricky, and there's still a lot we don't know about the modes of action or the treatment potential. So let's dive in with a clinical pilot study on transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS, by first author Arendesh and last author Cao at NeuroM Therapeutics, which is an industry partner, and the University of South Florida. And the paper is published in Medicines, and the title is Transcranial Electromagnetic Treatment Stops Alzheimer's Disease Cognitive Decline Over a 2.5-year Period, a pilot study. The authors recently published a paper on the promising cognitive effects of 2 months of daily in-home electromagnetic treatment. They abbreviate this to TEMT, and from my understanding, TMS and TEMT are the same, but don't quote me on that. So that study was conducted in 8 participants with mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. And in addition to the cognitive enhancement they saw, these were also accompanied by changes in Alzheimer's-related blood and cerebrospinal fluid markers. So the authors decided to extend the study to a 2.5-year period in 5 participants in order to look at the long-term safety, cognitive assessments, and AD biomarker changes. They report that the treatment was safe over a 2.5-year period with no adverse side effects. The participants showed no decline in the 6 different cognitive and functional tasks the authors administered, which is promising given the expected decline within that time frame. They also found reductions in Alzheimer's-related biomarkers, including C-reactive protein, phospho-tau-217, amyloid beta-140, and amyloid beta-142. You can check the paper for more details. While this was a very small sample size, these results are promising for the safety and therapeutic potential of TEMT in Alzheimer's patients. If you've ever participated in a TMS or electrical stimulation study, you'll know that the devices can be a little clunky and tedious to take on and off. And then there's the aforementioned problem of low spatial and temporal resolution. In other words, the devices themselves still require optimization, and the authors of this next paper report on the development and testing of a new wearable device for delivering electromagnetic stimulation in paper number 8 entitled Numerical Analysis and Design of an EMF Birdcage Wearable Device for Treatment of Alzheimer's Disease, a Feasibility Study. This is by first author Perez and last author Rizgala, from the Indiana University School of Medicine in the US, and this was published in the Journal of Biomedical Science and Engineering. The authors developed a wearable device designed to generate and radiate a frequency of 64 MHz and a specific absorption rate of 0.6 watts per kilogram. The reason they chose these specific parameters is because they were able to decrease toxic levels of amyloid beta in cell cultures. Moreover, the 64 MHz frequency has good skin depth penetration, meaning it could reach deep brain tissues, passing through hair, skin, fat, dura, cerebrospinal fluid, and gray matter. Sorry about the noise. Kitty is very upset that I'm not paying more attention to her. The parameters they chose also take into consideration the safety of use by ensuring that they can be achieved with low power input and energy, and the dimensions of their stimulating coil fit within wearable systems. The authors provide a lot of technical details about the new device. If you're interested, you'll find those in the paper. They conclude by saying that the distribution of the electric field and specific absorption rate was applied equally over the simulated human head and was able to penetrate into the brain. Given the promising results of this feasibility study, perhaps I'll be reporting on a study with this device in real humans in the near future. Next up, we have two papers on acupuncture, which is a potential therapy that comes up on a monthly basis, often in direct combination with electrical stimulation in the form of electroacupuncture. So I'm including this under neuromodulatory techniques, although arguably in this paper, it's more of a complementary therapy. We're not looking at affecting neural activity directly, let's say. So this was published by first author Khan and last author Hong at the School of Mechanical Engineering in Pusan National University in Korea. And the title is Acupuncture Enhances Brain Function in Patients with Mild Cognitive Impairment, Evidence from a Functional Near-Infrared Spectroscopy Study. It was published in Neural Regeneration Research. This was an observational study in which the authors examined the effects of acupuncture therapy on patients with MCI. Specifically, they recruited 11 healthy individuals and 11 MCI patients, all of which completed a working memory task at the onset of the study. During that task, the authors used functional near-red spectroscopy to monitor oxy and deoxyhemoglobin signals in the prefrontal cortex. That is, they looked at hemodynamic changes in the brain area related to working memory. The participants with MCI then underwent 6 weeks of acupuncture with two sessions a week before doing a second round of cognitive testing. This in turn was followed by another 6 week round of acupuncture and a final round of testing in the MCI group. The healthy control group was only tested at the beginning and did not undergo acupuncture. So note that all the comparisons in the results are made to the baseline test. The authors used statistical analysis of the hemoglobin signals to make a classification system between healthy controls and MCI patients, which was nearly 86% accurate when the two groups were compared at baseline. The authors found that there were changes in the temporal characteristics of the hemodynamic response in MCI patients following acupuncture. The classification accuracy decreased after the MCI group underwent acupuncture, which suggests that the participants' hemodynamic response became more comparable to those of healthy subjects. It's not detailed in the abstract if they tested cognitive function directly, but these results do suggest that acupuncture could induce cognitive processing-related brain changes in patients with MCI. Paper 10 describes the protocol for an upcoming clinical trial to evaluate the efficacy and safety of acupuncture. This was published in Trials by first author Fu and last author Wang at Shanghai University of Traditional Chinese Medicine. And the title is Effective Acupuncture with Donepezil Based on Syndrome Differentiation on Cognitive Function in Patients with Mild to Moderate Alzheimer's Disease, a Study Protocol for a Multi-Center Randomized Controlled Trial. The authors plan to recruit 184 AD patients, who will be randomly divided into an acupuncture group or a control group. All participants will receive donepezil hydrochloride, which is commonly used to treat dementia or at least manage some symptoms. The donepezil treatment will help differentiate specific syndromes, and acupuncture will be administered for 12 weeks. The authors will look at post-treatment changes in the Alzheimer's Disease Assessment Scale, specifically the cognition scores, as a primary outcome, but they'll also be looking at the following assessments: mini mental state exam, Alzheimer's Disease Cooperative Research Activity Daily Life, and quality of life Alzheimer's disease. So these are different measures, not only related to cognition, but also to quality of life and daily activities. All assessments will be performed at baseline, immediately following the treatment, and at a 24 and 26 week follow-up. If you want to follow the study, you can find the details for the trial registration in the paper. We've got two papers to go here, and they're a little different from our usual. You'll see why from the title of this next paper, which is paper number 10, Effects of Chronic Vagal Nerve Stimulation in the Treatment of Beta-Amyloid-Induced Neuropsychiatric Symptoms. This is by first author Yesil Tepi and last author Sara from Rutgers University in New Jersey, as well as Hacettepe University in Turkey, and this paper was published in the European Journal of Pharmacology. About half of AD patients also display neuropsychiatric symptoms such as anxiety, depression, or other mood disorders. While Alzheimer's research and treatment development has focused primarily on cognitive decline, many of these other debilitating symptoms remain unaddressed. The authors are interested in the potential of vagal nerve stimulation for treating neuropsychiatric symptoms in AD, as this strategy has been used in the context of epilepsy, stroke rehabilitation, and major depression. Here they look at vagal nerve stimulation in a rat model of Alzheimer's. The rats received an intracerebroventricular injection of amyloid beta, which results in memory impairment and depression-like behaviors. They then received chronic vagal nerve stimulation, that is at a 30 Hz frequency for 5 minutes a day, but you have to check the paper for the specific details. Vagal nerve stimulation caused an improvement in memory function and showed strong antidepressant and anxiolytic effects, which persisted specifically in the amyloid beta-treated rats compared to the non-treated rats. Both groups showed decreased aggressiveness and increased locomotor activity following vagal nerve stimulation, and the authors further report on changes to glutamatergic receptor levels in the hippocampus. Overall, these results in an Alzheimer's rat model suggest that vagal nerve stimulation may be viable for treating depression and anxiety without impairing cognition. And that brings us to the final paper of today. This one is more specifically about targeting amyloid beta, so we're going to get a little bit more mechanistic here. If this is your jam, check out our previous episodes and bibliographies on amyloid beta's role in Alzheimer's and pharmacological studies that target it directly. Onwards to paper 11, which is entitled Stable Cavitation Interferes with Amyloid Beta 1622 Oligomerization. The first author is Mann, the last author is Wang, and this is at the University of Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. Paper 11 was published in the Journal of Chemical Information and Modeling. The use of scanning ultrasound has previously been shown to remove amyloid beta aggregates in the mouse brain and to improve memory in an AD mouse model. At a more molecular level, studies have shown that ultrasound-induced bubble cavitation causes amyloid fibrils to fragment, and that ultrasonic pulses accelerate the depolarization of amyloid beta fibrils into monomers. From what I understand, bubble cavitation is when little cavities or bubbles form under pressure in a liquid, and these can collapse and generate shock waves. Apparently, applied ultrasound can cause microbubbles to be either in a stable oscillating state or unstable inertial cavitation state, which would have differential effects. You can check the paper for details, as this is really not my area of expertise. Here, the authors developed a non-equilibrium molecular dynamics simulation algorithm to examine the molecular mechanism of amyloid beta oligomerization under stable cavitation. They found that stable cavitation inhibited oligomeric formation and prevented the formation of beta-rich oligomers, and a network of state transitions further showed that stable cavitation altered the oligomerization pathways of amyloid beta 1622 peptides. All in all, this study reports on a useful simulation tool for optimizing the experimental condition in order to achieve the best therapeutic effect from ultrasound-induced microbubble cavitation. I know that was a bit of a deep dive to end on, but we are at the end of our episode, and I hope that you have found it useful and accessible, or at the very least that you've learned something interesting today. Thank you very much for listening, and I would like to thank the whole team at Aminder for their hard work. In particular, I would like to thank the sorting team, that is, Sarah Luady, Edin Dubcek, Ben Cornish, Christy Yu, Dana Clausen, Kevin Nishimura, Ellen Kosh, and Ellen Rowe. I would also like to thank Judy for reviewing my script today, Isabel for editing the audio, and the audio was also reviewed by Anusha Kamesh, who is the talented soul behind our Aminder music. If you want to check out her other work, I encourage you to go to SoundCloud and look up Anusha Kamesh, or you can find her at AK Music on YouTube. Sarah did the bibliography for today's episode, and the word cloud was created by Lara. Aminder is really a group effort that is run on the time and energy of volunteers. If ever you'd like to come behind the scenes with us and perhaps work on your science communication skills, we are always looking for more people. You can send us an email expressing your interest at aminderpodcast@gmail.com. Besides that, please feel free to share our podcast with anyone who might benefit from it. And you can always reach out to us on social media if you have any ideas on how we could improve our podcast, or if you just want to leave us a little motivational word. With that, this is my last episode before the holidays, so I'm wishing you a very happy holiday and a good start to the new year. I'll be back with you in 2023. See ya!